You're listening to a Speech Therapy PD podcast. Earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode by completing the accompanying course online at speechtherapypd.com.
Welcome to the Gestalt Get Together, presented by speechtherapypd.com. Each episode has its own accompanying course on speechtherapypd.com. The Gestalt Get Together is your podcast for discussing the state of the evidence of Gestalt language processing, associated therapy modalities, and how our field is responding to the frameworks of GLP and NLA. I'm Corinne Smoos, MS, CCC, SLP, a musical language therapist who's dedicated to celebrating while investigating Gestalt language processing, protecting the scientific method, and reducing cognitive linguistic biases about this framework and these clients that I love so much. This podcast is intended to help you embrace, investigate, and analyze your unique role in child development for Gestalt language processors without getting in your own way. This podcast is a celebration of neurodivergent learning, and we look forward to you learning with us along the way. Hi, and welcome to the Gestalt Get Together. This is your podcast. We're talking about Gestalt language processing, the autistic neurotype, musical language, psychoacoustics, and really anything that's related to that in our field. Whether you're joining here for a live interview or maybe an episode that does more of a research deep dive, I'm really happy that you are here listening live or afterwards. My name is Corinne Smoos, MS-CCC-SLP. I love GLPs. I work with them literally every day. It's basically my whole caseload. And I've had huge success working within proposed frameworks like NLA. And also, I want more evidence. I want more research and I want more data. I call myself lovingly skeptical. And I basically live in the journals. I hope to bring in some research today during this live interview so that you know where to look to learn more about these topics and become more confident working with Gestalt language processors. Now, this podcast recording is going to be 1 hour and 30 minutes. It's offered for 0.15 ASHA CEUs. Now, if you're listening and you're like, hey, I really want to get credit for listening to that episode, definitely check out Speech Therapy PD. They have a wealth of resources so that you can get your continuing education going on and get all of that squared away for your license, relicense, all of that. So what are we talking about tonight? We are, of course, talking about Gestalt language processors, but we're going to be thinking about our littlest GLPs, and especially in the settings of daycares and preschools. There's a lot of discourse out there about working with GLPs in private practices. But if you're in early intervention, you know that working with teachers, early childhood educators is really, really important. And that's why I'm thrilled to have my friend Bridget here, who's going to tell us more about herself and her work. But she is working in early intervention with GLPs, and I'm so excited to have her. Bridget, welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. So I'm Bridget Hoffman. I am a speech therapist. I have my own practice, Small Talk Therapeutics, and I live in Philadelphia. I went to Temple University for my undergrad and grad school. When I was in grad school, I completely thought I was going to work with adults and pretty quickly shifted to the early intervention population. So like the complete opposite end of the spectrum. So I do all home health care. So I'm either in preschools or in people's homes. And I would say right now, 90% of my caseload is in the school setting. So definitely brings some unique challenges that I feel like aren't always touched on in like the social media world, the research world. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, so let's go back in time a little bit. I like to talk to a lot of people in the world of Gestalt language processing about how you came across these ideas in this framework and what has the transformation looked like for you becoming, you know, a therapist who works with GLPs and really seem to identify with that. So what does that transformation look like?
Yeah, I feel like probably similar to a lot of other people. I graduated grad school, and that was in, 2016, had my tools, my tool belt from that. I provided treatment and early intervention, just plugging along, and things just weren't really working. And I feel like the pandemic, so quite a few years after I had started working out in the field, the pandemic really gave a lot of us therapists some time where we were home. Social media was becoming bigger. It wasn't like I was coming home from work and I could turn my work brain off. Like you're constantly being flooded with these things. So, started to learn about Gestalt language processing, and it totally, I saw my clients like in my head. And you get pits in your stomach thinking about all of the clients that you miss that you're no longer with. And I still like, I think about all of them. And I really started to go down that research rabbit hole, taking courses, fully immersing myself in it. I mean, thank you to my early intervention population because they got to be the guinea pigs as I fumbled my way through my approach. And I feel like as a therapist, I was always pretty child-led, but really learning to decrease the demands. Learning about different neurotypes and like I feel like it just made such a difference. Things really clicked. But it was probably like 2020, 2021. And I feel like when I initially learned about it, I like peaked and was like, wow, this is amazing. I have all the answers. This is going to be incredible. And then since then, I feel like I've come down quite a bit. And I find myself still as a strong therapist, but in a very gray area with a lot more questions. But I think that's good. And I don't think if you get back to that area, you've fully immersed yourself in this like learning journey. And Corinne, I know like your disclaimer in the beginning is that you are lovingly skeptical. And I feel like that's where I am as well. It's so beautiful. It changes everything about my work. I love Gestalt language processing. I love the frameworks. But I'm in a very different place now than I was when I first started, with how I approach everything. And I know we're going to touch on the daycares, but that's a huge part of this.
I completely relate to that. And I think you and I met when I was in my rah, rah, rah stage. And like, I still am in a lot of ways. Like, I literally have a podcast about GLPs. It's all I talk about all day. My friends are sick of it. But I'm not in that space of like, I'm trying to be more discerning because the framework on its own is fan like it's great. There's all these fun ideas. It's really exciting. I see my clients in it, but there's all these other factors that can make those ideas difficult to implement. And then we have to there's we can have this great recipe, but we might not have all the ingredients and all of the settings to make that recipe. So we've got to modify it. That's where I've really had to step back. And I'd say like the last year and a half, I used to be rah, 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 and now I'm just rah, rah. Because it's like there's more that's got to go into it. So I'm really excited about this topic, which is why I'm talking so fast, because I really grew up in early intervention. That is where I became a therapist. And the interactions with teachers can really make or break that therapeutic relationship with the kid and the kind of outcomes that we're seeing. And we can empower ourselves. Ideas and like frameworks beyond GLP, things like potentially pulling from ACT, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But what can we do as interventionists to pair with those teachers, build those relationships so that the therapy actually lands? So you've talked about how you came into learning about Gestalt language processing and how it shifted over time. Paint us a picture about like what you do when you go into classrooms. Some people may have never done this kind of service delivery before.
So going into classrooms, I mean, this is so simple, but something that I've not done in the past sometimes if I'm really busy. But I feel like starting before you even walk in the door, calling the daycare, introducing yourself, letting them know who you're there for, asking them what the best time to come is, like just immediately setting the rapport of like, this is your place that I'm coming into to help support you. It's not me, the expert, coming in to change the way that you're doing things. So, there's certainly been times where I have a cancellation, I just pop into a daycare unannounced, but as much as you can, really trying to call. And so if this is my first time in the daycare, it's me coming in, putting my bag down, and just introducing myself to the teacher. It's so simple, but teacher names, I'm really, really bad with names. So this is something that I have to be so mindful of. But making sure that they know your name, I'll leave a business card just so that they have my contact information. I'll leave my cell phone number, my email address, and setting the stage that this is like an open pathway. And if the session allows for it, depends on, the vibes of the classroom that day, but trying to ask the teacher some questions about how the classroom runs and what is really important to them. So a lot of times this is where things will come up about they need their kids to sit during circle time because they're being watched by their supervisor and this is the criteria that they're given. So if I didn't have that background from the teacher, to me, I'd be giving them strategies that go against what they're being told at their job. Immediate disconnect. So really learning about like the way that they teach, what their values are of a teacher, and what they find is making the classroom setting challenging, specifically from a communication standpoint.
I think those are good ones to start off with because a lot of those are so simple and they can make like just leaving your business card because you're a stranger. I think also you're bringing up so many memories of when I was doing this, and I'll never forget that I went into a classroom and I was, oh my gosh, I was so bright-eyed and I was like, I'm gonna change this kid's life. Like I was so ready to go. And I started coaching a teacher right away, and she looks at me. She goes, "It's my first day here." It's like, oh my gosh, I didn't ask anything about her or like those conversations to actually figure out like what's the positionality of this person I'm talking to. I'm seeing them as like. Of like the role they can play for this child, but like what is their role in their own life, first of all? How long have they been working here? Who are they as a teacher? Do they like teaching? Are they hoping to find another job in the future? There was some really strong rapport that I built with daycare teachers when I worked in DC because I was having conversations and they were really honest that they're like, I don't like working here. And we have to connect over that of how can we maybe come up with strategies to make your day more tolerable. But I found out a couple of them, when I described my job, they're like, oh, I think I want to go to school for that. So then the Therapeutic Alliance was like, how can we get you ready to go to speech therapy? It's like, who is that person you're talking to? But finding that out before you're like, all right, do this, do this, do this.
I think that's so important, and I feel like that comes up a lot of people being like, I don't really like my job. And I think acknowledging right off the bat, like with teachers, is just telling them, like, this is really hard. Like, I get to come in here for 45 minutes and then I get to drive in my car, listen to whatever I want. No one is asking me anything to my next session. So, that right there is a very different experience between you and I. And my cup is going to be way more filled than yours is when I'm modeling these strategies or trying to do them for you. So I think the same way we approach our kids with making sure their cup is filled and that they're regulated in this optimal place for learning, I feel like I really pull that energy into the teacher too. Like, what can I do to help this teacher feel more regulated? Or like, how can I support her, make this any bit easier? And I feel like I didn't always go in with that mentality. I went in directly with, like you said, I'm gonna change this kid's life. Like, they're gonna be regulated. I'm gonna have the best session. Like, and when you do that, you might have a really good session, but you're not gonna have really good carryover. And I'm only there, 45 minutes tops, two times a week. Not much is going to happen, in that time. Just like parent coaching, it's we really there's a reason why all of the early intervention programs are moving towards parent coaching model because it works. So with that, we really have to find strategies that these teachers can implement.
Yeah, what you just said reminded me of there's a paper I read in preparation for our talk tonight. It's from 2009 by Feinstein, Fielding, Udvari, Sollner, and Joshi. And it's about adolescence and pharmacological intervention, but there are some interesting things in there about rapport. The title is, and I will put in the chat for those of you who are here live, it's called The Supporting Alliance in Child and Adolescent Treatment, Enhancing Collaboration Among Therapists, Parents, and Teachers. So of course that came up when I was doing my search, just a different age group. But what Feinstein and all talked about is there's four propositions related to authority over a child in the therapeutic setting. So I'm gonna read a quote. I'm going to do a couple mitigations just to make it more in line for who we're talking about. But quote, the following four propositions point to ways in which the therapist is not the ultimate authority in the treatment of a pediatric patient. The word authority implies both control and expertise. The first two propositions refer to authority as control. Number one, the vast majority of interpersonal interactions, including many that have consequences for the child's therapy, and some that are explicitly therapeutic in nature, are not controlled or managed by the therapist. The vast majority of those interactions, they're not. I'm coming in and out of the quote. I apologize. Okay, continue the quote. Number two, in the case of therapy, the therapist is responsible for selecting therapeutic interventions, but rarely controls or supervises all of their delivery. Number three is about expertise and information. Number three, the therapist often has comparatively limited contact with the child and little direct access to information about the child's daily life. And number four, the therapist's perspective on the appropriate goals of therapy has no clear moral priority over other perspectives, including those of the child's family, and the society in which the child lives. End quote. All right, any thoughts on that?
A lot of thoughts on that. I feel like that is something that everything that you had just stated in that quote are things that have changed the way that I move into daycares over the last few years. I definitely, especially when I was in my peak of learning about things like Gestalt language processing and introducing high-tech AAC, I feel like I had this like authority of like, this is the best thing for the child. And it always came from a good place, but it wasn't an effective place. And like just really coming in and being like, this, I know that this is the best thing for the kid. When like, no, I don't. Who am I? I'm coming in well-intentioned, but it's just not the right way to go about it, or it's not the most effective way. I really like that quote.
Yeah, and there's definitely points in it that I think like people might have disagreements with or like qualms about, which I'd be curious to hear about. But so I think the general ideas behind it, even just to reconsider what your authority is or looks like or how you perceive yourself as an authority, I think that I'm really grateful for starting my career in early intervention because it really helped me like to at least try to level myself and be like, we are like no one is above anyone else here. And there's kind of like there's a quote that flies around all the time of like, I'm an expert on language, but you're the expert on your kid. Like I might know a lot about your kids, but I'll never be the expert on them because I don't know. I've never been at bedtime. I don't wake them up in the morning. But I'm thinking about, with this idea of authority and expertise, I think it can, I can speak personally, like it definitely has and continues to cloud some of the decision making because we're not going to live with that child. We don't live with them. We don't take them home with us. And our relationship with them will come to an end one day. But we're thinking about the people who have longer term relationships and are they actually involved in the decision making process for things that are going to impact them for years, if not the entire lifetime. Maybe not necessarily with the teachers, but you could also argue that the way that you're pairing with the teachers and the things that you're helping them learn about, that can have a really huge ripple effect in your community too. So it's not just that kid, but if you effectively build a relationship with a teacher and pass on information that they that they actually value, because you know they value it because you know about their values, then that next autistic kid who's in their class, that next GLP, they might already know what to do.
Exactly. And I like how you just touched on values, because that's something that I used to not even have a conversation with families about. I feel like it never really was at the forefront of my mind, or I just felt like, of course, people's values align with my values. We want to do what's best for the kid. But the spectrum of values is so large that that's now something I come back to, is talking about values with parents, values with teachers, and then sharing what my values are. And is there overlap? Do we have different values? Because that's really, really going to drive the conversations, the way I approach different strategies. Can I implement a strategy and relate it to their values in some way? And then that might make it click a little bit more and easier to carry over. I feel like the idea of having different values is huge.
What are some of the values that you assumed or that you felt were like implicit with other people that maybe you've been questioning more?
And I should say, it's not to say people don't have these values. I always feel like when I share my values, I talk a lot about acceptance, open-mindedness, and kindness. Those are like my three big ones that I really try and bring into every case. And with one of my values being open-mindedness, that is learning that other people might have a very different experience or perspective as to like what I'm trying to bring in. For me, like acceptance, especially in the neurodivergent population, is accepting the child as they are, not promoting things like masking, honoring total communication, being strength-based. And a teacher who has never had a background on some of that stuff might not have the language to show that value to me. And so I feel like that's somewhere where I have to like take a step back. And, sometimes when I'm chatting with a teacher about a child, and I'm hearing some words that I'm not necessarily liking, just taking a step back and thinking, like, oh, it's not that they don't accept this child or they're not affirming, but they just might not have the language right now. And I feel like I did some writing off before where I was like, oh, they're not neurodiversity affirming, they're not accepting this child that I'm supporting in this classroom. And I feel like that was always like a little bit of a barrier for me, that I've really taken a step back. I have a list of values too, of like, there's like 50 values on there that I'll share. And just to kind of like let people look through and identify, like, if they've never thought about what their value system are, to look through that and, kind of come up with things that are really speaking to them.
Yeah, and I think like if we're pulling from, because when I think about values, I think about sociology and like there's different dimension of values too. There's economic value, religious, spiritual. I'm trying to think of other ones. But even like aesthetic values, linguistic values, and they're extremely informed by the different circles that we're raised in. So like the family circle, community, onward and outward, they're based on the language that we're exposed to. And I think what you're saying about like the idea of like even like, oh, they're not neurodiversity affirming, it's like we're just wanting to like really pause and interrogate, like, is that the case, or is they're just using different words that don't signal to my brain the same thing? Maybe the symbols that we're exchanging, like in form of language, aren't referencing it, but like underneath it, yes, we do have the same shared value for the child.
I was gonna say, are you familiar with there's a this training in Philly called Attachment Biobehavioral Catch-Up?
Never heard of it.
The acronym is ABC, and in Philadelphia, kids can qualify for this. And it's a fully based, like, parent coaching, like, therapeutic approach. It's 10 weeks long. And you go through this whole, like, protocol with the parents, just talking about how the way that they were parented, even if we don't know it or we want to do the opposite, will influence the way that we parent our kids. And Like bringing that up to think about how the ways we were raised are like impacting what we're doing with our kids is basically the big thing. But I feel like I have brought a lot of that training over to the teachers as well. Like the way that they were taught in their classrooms is going to be how they teach, whether they liked it or they didn't. It's so rooted. And I don't know. I feel like that was like kind of random, but it's been something that I've been thinking a lot about now is just this idea of you were mentioning like family circles and community circles. And I feel like it's so hard to also come in and coach or support teachers to teach in a way that they maybe weren't taught. And like it's just a really interesting dynamic, you know, even though I don't remember what my daycare classes were like or my preschool classes, it's ingrained in you somewhere, you know?
Yeah, the idea of like it being deeply rooted, there's a Medium article by someone named Blake J. Wise from 2024 about value systems, and there's a quote that I like. It's our value system functions as an internal compass, guiding our choices and actions. It operates through a series of cognitive processes that assess and prioritize different options based on our deeply held beliefs. This process is often subconscious, influenced by our upbringing, societal norms, and personal experiences. I like the visual of the compass because I think that could be a compelling one to talk about with people, or even just think about for yourself, like, what is my internal compass? Where is north for me? And like, where am I heading, even though I may not know that I'm being pulled that way? When I think
And
about
then, like,
that, yeah.
I was gonna say, like, what if your compass is different than the compass of the teacher or the parent that you're working with, you know? And it's interesting. And sometimes that puts us in a position to be like, okay, now I have to think outside the box. Like, now this isn't as inherent for me. And that can be hard.
And also, like, oh, maybe I'm really wrong. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Like,
Do I know anything?
yeah, I mean, that's a swing. And like, when I think about the pendulum, which, like, as a recovering all or nothing thinker, ooh, I gotta stay away from that. But it's like, it's just so important to be like, okay, well, maybe my ideas are evidence-based and like correct in some circles, but the kid in front of me in this daycare, in this city, in this political climate, in this world, is that actually correct for them and their ecosystem and their circumstances? So let's kind of pull back, and I want you to imagine that you got assigned a new kid today, and you're looking at the paperwork, whatever, and you're like, oh, this might be a GLP. And that's happened to me in the past where I got paperwork for a new early intervention client, and they're like, he only talks about owls. And I was like, all right, sounds like my kind of guy. It's like, I'll take. I remember telling my boss, I was like, that's my case.
Yeah, I want
That's
it.
mine. Maybe an owl kid. But let's say a GLP comes across your desk. What would that first session look like? Like when you're thinking about talking about a teacher's values or family values?
So typically when I pick up a case, I am almost, like I said, primarily in the preschool system. So that's usually a call to the parent. And if I can get a call with them, I'll try and get a little bit of a case history, not from what's on the paper, but more just, okay, tell me about like what the child's day looks like. What do they like to do? Do they like to watch TV? Do they like to sit on their iPad? What does sitting on the iPad look like? And I ask these questions in an exciting way. Like, oh, does when they're on the iPad, are they ever manipulating the media? Are they rewinding? Do they play around with, the volume? Are they making it go fast? Do they like the logo intro? And sometimes it just blows these parents' mind because all of a sudden their child is like being seen and they're like, whoa, yes, they do that. And typically when they're going into their pediatrician or maybe talking with friends, they're constantly hearing how you put your kid in front of a screen too much, like look at how good they are at navigating that, you know. It's usually looked at as a negative. So one of the first ways that I connect with parents, I feel like, is to talk about their screen time and scripting as a huge strength that I am so excited to learn more about. And I always ask the parent too, like, what is your child interested in? And if I can, bringing that into my first session, whether that is through, like, if I have my talker and I have a category that, like, I know if they're into space, I might be pulling up that, a space folder on one of them. And there have been times too, one of my friends gave me this idea of we shared a learner who loved cars, and she got a Lightning McQueen shirt and wore it to the session. And it was like amazing. And now I do that all the time. Like, I'm like,
That's a really good idea.
it's so amazing. Like, if you're just having a little bit of difficulty connecting with a child, or you're not really sure where to go, like, showing up in a t-shirt with their interest is like amazing. So, but even if it's not that, even if you're not buying a t-shirt, I have like so many random shirts. But even if you're not doing that, just finding out what their interests are. Everyone has a phone in their pocket. Sometimes if I'm just sitting next to a child, I'll kind of pull up a video, or I'll play a song that the mom had told me that they liked, and just kind of giving them this message like, hey, I'm a safe person for you. We're gonna connect, and this is gonna be really, really fun. And so I feel like that's one of the biggest ways that I bring in my conversation with the parent into the school. And then when I'm coming into the school, we already kind of talked about how we're approaching the teachers, making sure they know who we are, not just coming in and definitely not pulling our kid out, trying our best to push in. A disclaimer that I usually say to the teachers right off the bat, too, because this is something that's stressful, is I do not care if other kids come over to me. In fact, that's very helpful because now I'm going to be able to advocate, or now I'm going to be able to model some self-advocacy language for my learner. And also, it's going to give me an idea of, is this strategy even going to work when all of these kids are coming? And I find if you allow other kids to come in the beginning, you're gonna become less interesting over time, versus if the teacher's like, no, that's Corinne's teacher. Everyone get away. They're all like, what is it? I need to be over there. So I think always having that disclaimer of just like, everyone can come over. I'm totally fine with it. I'm gonna jump in with what you're doing. If a teacher's handing out a snack and they're on the other side of the table, hey, do you mind if I help you open up these kids' snacks? And just giving them a helping hand, like make yourself valuable for that teacher. And you get an idea of what it feels like to do the task that the teachers are doing while implementing some GLP strategies. So, one of the first ones I feel like that is, I would say majority of the time, a strategy I can give right away without even knowing much is like decreasing questions and demands.
I knew you were going to say that first.
It's just one where, like, before I can even like learn about the child's scripting or their interest or maybe what their video gestalts are or songs they like, that's immediately something that I can usually give some feedback for. It's a really easy model. And a way that I'll typically bring that up is through like I wonder statements. So like, I wonder what would happen like if we, instead of asking that as a question, if we did it as a statement or whatever it is. But kind of using those I wonder statements to prompt the teacher to just think about like, what if I did do that in another way? And also, it's not, you need to do it this way because this is the right way. And it also gives the teacher to be like, yeah, I've tried that and it doesn't work, or it gives the teacher an opportunity to give me feedback and let me know how they're feeling about this strategy, this model, whatever it is.
I really like all of those. I feel like we need to like type all this up into a document after. One that I really like to do is and I do this with parents too when I'm starting as much as I can. I ask them what they're already really good at. And starting off there, I'm like, why are you like, what makes you a really good teacher? And then, like, sometimes they get a little embarrassed, they get a little blushy, but it's like, tell me about you, or like, why, what are you really good at with so and so? Because
I like that.
I can't, like, I can't, I'm trying to imagine it on the other side. If I were that teacher, and a therapist came in to help with, making the relationship easier, helping my students succeed, I'd feel like I'm not doing enough. I'm doing it wrong. It wouldn't feel good. And if it were only criticisms or recommendations or like demands or commands of what to do, I might not even feel like you're seeing me and my strengths as a teacher. It also helps you narrow down to what strategies to give to. Like you said, if they have opportunities to say, like, I already do that, but you can even do that in a gentler way that's making them feel valued of like, what are you already really strong at? Tell me when you shine with so and so. Like
I like that.
what part of the day are you two like in cahoots? Tell me that.
Yeah, I like that. That's another, it's a big structure of that ABC program that I was telling you about. When you're working with parents, you literally have to give, I want to say it's like down to a number of like, you have to give five positive comments before you're allowed to give a strategy. And it could be, it got you, it helped me really get good at finding the tiniest things. Like I'd be like, oh, your child picked up the cup and you smiled at them. That was such good following their lead. I love it. That was so good. And just trying to, I love how you said, like picking up the things that they're already doing really well. I feel like complimenting teachers is just like an underrated thing of like, oh, I love how you're doing that. And they're just like, oh, thank you. These kids don't ever tell me that, you know? And I feel like that's such a good point. And so I think like just being complimentary goes such a long way too in things that they're already doing.
Yeah. I'm like, you don't have to be like over the top, like, oh my gosh, I love, just be like, hey, that was really cool you just did. And I think drawing attention to the things that you know are just second nature to them. Because, and that's what I'll tell people too in the beginning, especially of like a coaching relationship. I've been doing a lot more virtual coaching, being like, I'm going to, together, like we're going to come up with ways that I think are going to be really helpful, but I'm also going to bring your attention to what you're already doing well so you can amp it up, you can enhance it. And the amount of times I've seen someone's shoulders drop when they hear that, they're like, oh, I'm already doing things that help my kid. It's kind of heartbreaking, because I think that the information that maybe parents or like early childhood educators get or the feedback they get is pretty negative. And so I think the idea of like, wait, I'm already doing things that actually help this kid can be really relieving.
Yeah, I really like that. Just like laying it off the, like right from the start of, I'm going to be telling you all the things you're doing well so that we could do more of it. And it's just like exciting, you know?
Another one that I love doing, some people don't like it, but underneath it, they're like, there's always a smile underneath the Corinne, I hate when you ask that. I'll do it between caregivers, especially between parents, and I'll do it between co-teachers. I'll be like, tell me one thing that so and so did really well this past week. So they have to compliment the other person. And that has been really helpful for like building that relationship in terms of like a triad. So I think about it, and actually it's what would it be like a quadrangle? What would four be? Like parent, I don't know. Parent. Most of my GLPs would know what the word would be. Parent, child, therapist, or teacher, child, therapist. If we're strengthening what, and I'm going to reference this soon, these secondary alliance. The primary alliance would be you, child. Secondary alliances between the people around the child, there's actually evidence that strengthening those can improve outcomes, which feels obvious. It feels like, oh, it's cool to see that the evidence supports that. But if you are two caregivers raising a child who the world is not built for, who might have like many like complicated overlapping diagnoses, you just got that diagnosis, or two teachers who might have some tension between you, you might not get along that well, creating opportunities to notice each other and compliment each other in small ways can really help build those relationships too.
I am going to use that. I love the idea of asking the teachers to compliment each other. Because I do, I work with a lot of teachers that have great relationships, and I feel like it's always easier to talk about something that someone else is doing really well than how you're doing. So I think that would bring up a lot of really cool things.
Yeah, and I use the declaratives, or I encourage them to use the declarative. I haven't found a way. I think it's like, tell me. I do it with declaratives. Like, tell me one thing you noticed. And try not to make it like over the top of like, tell me something they like succeeded at. Just like, what did you notice them do really well with so and so this?
What was working well?
And that's another thing where I just see people kind of like their shoulders drop and they're like, okay. It's bigger than like, it's not right and wrong. It's not pass fail. This is a human experience we're having with other humans.
I love that.
We've been talking a lot about values, and that's one of the biggest ones that comes up in this approach called ACT or ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. And I know you're up in Philly, so you're by our buddies Unfurling Littles. And I know they're big. If those of you who are listening haven't looked into Unfurling Littles, please do. They are a really cool progressive ABA company who puts out, they put out great content and perspectives, but they really draw from acceptance and commitment therapy, which it pulls from the psychotherapy world and cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a branch of those two, but we can adopt ideas and modify them for speech language pathology. And it can really help with working with clients, but I think about it in our case with early intervention, really helping parents and teachers to acknowledge, like to think about avoidance, denial, struggling with inner emotions, and actually turning towards acceptance and then committing to taking action. It was developed in the 1980s by a psychologist at the University of Nevada, Stephen C. Hayes. And it was actually, he developed it based on his own experience of panic attacks. And so he developed it off his own lived experience, and he didn't want to run from himself anymore. He wanted to accept himself and accept his lived experiences and then take action from that. And it's this idea that like negative human emotions are actually really valuable signals from our body about what's going on in relationship to the environment. And we don't have to fix, manage, or change them, but we can experience them as part of the whole, or perhaps the gestalt of being a human. And so I know that because you interact with Unfurling Littles and like this idea, ideas behind ACT and ACT, they relate to values. Where do you see overlaps of ACT or ACT with the work that you do?
Like you were saying, we've learned so much from Maggie about this. And I feel like it came up a lot when I was on my rah-rah-rah of Gestalt language processing and how I was providing models and things like that. I was doing a lot of maybe modeling emotions that I thought the child was doing, or modeling all of these things that were happening. And I feel like with ACT, you talk a lot about accepting feelings as they are, and also not labeling feelings for that child that they may or may not be feeling. Like their outward cues may not be how they're feeling inside. So I feel like that thinking changed the way that I model for Gestalt language processors. If anything, it makes me a little bit more quiet during my sessions so that when I am modeling language, it's feeling like it's more thoughtful and meaningful for that child. So I feel like that was a big one. And also just like this idea of, okay, this is the way that I'm feeling. Let's think about my values or my guiding principles. What can I do in this situation to align with that? And I feel like that was a piece that I was missing a little bit. And it's helped me as a therapist. It's helped me relate to my clients a little bit better. But it's really, really cool to see ACT in action. If you ever get the chance and you're in Philly and you can like visit Maggie's ABA center, she now has like a school, and it's
Beautiful.
stunning. It's so beautiful. Have you been?
No, but we're trying to plan a like a music event together.
That would be really awesome.
I'm
Our
gonna
office is right there, so you can come in and see our little closet. It's cute, but so her space is so beautiful, and it's such a cool experience to come in and watch all of these providers supporting their kids through this system of values where every child just like is so authentically themselves, and so are the RBTs. And it's changed the way that I do things. Like now, when we have employees and they do sessions there, they're like, this is so nice. My burnout is so high. And then you can like go into a space like that and be like, okay, it can be like this. Now, that space is beautiful. Everyone there is on the same path. But sometimes we have to have building blocks to get that like little utopia into the preschools and daycare centers that we're going into. And I feel like that's where I have a little bit of a challenge still sometimes. I am still trying to figure all of that out. But it's really cool to see all of it in action. And just honoring how kids are feeling, setting compassionate boundaries, whether their reactions are positive or negative, like just letting kids show up exactly as who they are.
And for Gestalt language processors, like, I don't know if this is with the GLPs you interact with, but they can really sense, the ones I work with can sense my emotion, my stress level. If I walk into the room differently, I feel like they can sense and react to it. And so to imagine a whole center where even the therapists are being like their full selves would make an impact on connection, on stress level, on felt safety, especially for kids with demand avoidance. But I think what's really can be there's, gosh, I mean, we were talking about it earlier. The amount of barriers on these early childhood teachers, the pay is, I want to cry.
I know.
The intersection of race and SES and the caregiving professions. I mean, when I worked in DC, I was a white therapist walking into a classroom of black and brown women. And I was making four times as much as they were to think about one child at a time versus 13. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And so that's coming up to, I mean, the amount of responsibilities that they have at every given second is unreal. You mentioned ratio issues.
Ratio, most of them are managing the classroom, they're managing the curriculum, they're making lunches, they're putting lunch out, they're then having to clean up and do the dishes. Like it is 1 million hats.
Yeah, cots down, cots up, preschool director coming in and yelling at them, in, out, sick kid, angry parent. It is unbelievable the amount of responsibility on these mostly women. For very little pay. They're worried about their own kid. They're worried about their own autistic kid at home or their kids down the hall. So there's so much here. And then we're coming in being like, hey, can you make a radical shift to your behavior and your perspective? Just for free, free. It's a really, yeah. And it, I feel like it can be, if not done well, it can be really disrespectful to their current lived circumstances. And I think that when I think about the intersection, and I'm just learning about ACT and ACT, I think the like our conversation about values really opens up so much we can think about here. So if you're listening right now, definitely recommend looking into this. And learning more about it. But values is one of the core tenets. There's psychological flexibility. Developing psychological flexibility is one of the main ideas behind ACT or ACT. And values is one of them, one of those to develop psychological flexibility. I'm talking fast because I'm excited. I can hear my dad in Long Island right now saying, slow down, Rin. Slow down, Rin. I've been like this from the jump. But like, values can be in us, but we can also choose personal values too, and then strive to live according to them. And we can have the desire to like not avoid distress and not adhere to other people's expectations about like what a child can be or how we want to help them show up. And so I think that can come back to the conversations we have with these teachers about like what would be really important for this child to be able to do in your classroom. What would be really, really valuable for you to learn about how to show up for this kid? Because we're going to come in with an IFSP that's going to be like, boom, here's what we're working on. But if that actually doesn't align with the reality of the situation and the negative feelings that come up, there's going to be a lot of negative feelings in that room. But if we're pulling from ACT, we're saying, okay, those negative emotions are cues that we can then like channel and work with to take action. But we are not feeling those negative emotions that the teachers are. It's figuring out where are they and then what do they want to do to make change. If we're coming in with what to do to make change based on our values, we're not actually like aligning with that.
Yeah, I think that's so well said. And I feel like that's something where I'm always going to be working on it. We always will, because every time you think you maybe got it down at one school, you're going to go meet a different teacher, you know, that has a different system of values, and maybe I've changed or grown, or, you know, it's just ever changing. But I feel like if you can come back to something, and I'm by no means an expert in ACT or anything like that, I defer to Maggie. There's a couple really great Instagram accounts. Stephen Hayes, he has a book that you can listen to, and a book that you can listen to. Clearly, I don't do much reading, all audiobooks. But you know, just coming back to these people who have these frameworks, I think can be really helpful and allow you to like bring that experience into every different setting that you go into, and you know, hopefully make a more impactful change.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I wanted to touch on ACT today is because it is derived from like the behavior world and you know psychology as well, but I think there can be such like an iron gate that goes down between speech and ABA, and I used to be one of the people who would throw that gate down like no questions asked. But then there's the realities that these kids live in where ABA might be the only option, or it's there's but there's ideas we can pull from these different domains to inform what we do.
I also think, I mean, ABA, rightfully so, can get a really bad rap. I'm very lucky to live in a city where there are some ABA agencies that are doing really amazing things. And you know, hopefully that's the direction that things are going. But I do feel like speech therapy slides under the radar. And I would say there are so many speech therapists out there that are using the exact same principles of ABA. And no one bats an eye. Everyone's like, don't do ABA, but go to speech. And it's like, no, it's go to a therapist who maybe aligns with your values or is doing the work to be affirming or child-led or strength-based. I definitely was in a position before where I was like, no, ABA, bad all the time. And then you learn more about how, like, there's lobbyists out there that are like getting money funded to ABA. So this is what kids get access to. And who am I to tell a parent who is working all of the time, keeps getting calls that their kid has to get picked up from school, to say, no, don't get a one-to-one ABA RBT therapist. That is so harmful and privileged that like you can't have that hard line. You have to find ways to work with people. Like I said, I work a lot with Maggie's clinic, so that is amazing and collaborative. But I work with a lot of ABA agencies that don't support kids in the same way I do. And you have to come back in, just like we've been talking about with the teachers, meet them where they're at, model how things could be done different, and talk to them about those feelings that are coming up of like, tell me, like, why is that important for you to get the child to complete the worksheet in this way? And really, like, get curious about what's going on, and then hopefully make a little bit of a change.
I think, yeah, there you're just sparking some memories for me of when I would do push-ins into ABA centers for some of my clients. And I would pull some of those prompts and questions that I use with teachers. But something else I did was I asked them for help in areas that I knew where I was like, hey, can you observe me for like, because we do co-treats. I'm like, can you watch me for 5 minutes and like let me know like a behavior that you notice me doing, just to like because they've got an interesting, cool lens that I don't have. Do I agree with all of it? No. But like, can you like teach me something about how I'm interacting with this kid that I don't see because I've got like self-blindness, you know? I'm missing all these things. But yeah, I definitely wanted to bring an act to encourage people like go check this out. Go see what you can pull from this. Because a lot of the writing about ACT is like it sounds a lot like a GLP therapist writing it. It really does. It's very affirming of the unique individual self within their unique individual experiences and how they process the world. Okay. I want to talk about AAC. Do you want to talk about AAC?
I do. This is my favorite.
Okay. Because if we're thinking preschool classroom, if we're thinking daycare, we're thinking teacher relationships, we might also be thinking, oh no, AAC can be a really hard thing to coach, talk about, and implement. So paint us a picture. What's it like for you?
Yes. So, something that I have absolutely, I've gone through all of the different ways that you could do it. When I first started learning about, I didn't always introduce things like high tech AAC and early intervention. It wasn't necessarily that I wasn't presuming competence. Like even after grad school, I just was under the impression that these kids were too young when I was working birth to three. As I kind of went on this journey and learned that that's not the case, and I started implementing it myself, it was life changing. And while I was on that high peak, I would come in to schools and be like, this is their high tech AAC device. Have it out all the time and don't use hand over hand prompting and just model,
Good
just
luck.
model on, just
Bye.
model. Okay, I'll see
See
you. All right, there's all 30 kids that all want that iPad. I'll talk to you soon. Obviously, it didn't work. I would come in every week, and the iPad, rightfully so, would be in the backpack, and I would take it out and try and model. So, I've done a lot of work over the last few years of just trying to figure out what's the disconnect, asking teachers, what are the barriers to having this talker out for the child? And most of the time, they'll share that all of the other kids are trying to touch it. It's a distraction. Previously, this is where I would have talked about how the difference between an accommodation and an iPad for entertainment and things like that. But now this is where I try and just listen, acknowledge that that's really hard. Like I can totally see that. I see it happening right now. I completely understand what you're talking about. And then typically the next session after that, I'll try and bring in a book. Either I'll just bring it in or I'll purchase one for the daycare. I'll usually do like a day with no words, something that has AAC representation in it. And I'll ask the teacher, hey, would it be okay with you if I joined in on your circle time and either you read the book or I read the book? I think one of the barriers to these kids having this AAC device in the classroom is that they don't really understand what it is. It looks like an iPad. It works like an iPad. I mean, it is an iPad. That's going to be really hard to constantly redirect these other kids who also might have communication needs and could maybe benefit from something like an AAC device. And I'm just not their speech therapist. So I will typically come in, read a book that has AAC, talk to the kids about that. Something else I've been doing is like printing out core boards of whatever the child system is that they're using, so that there is an opportunity for the teacher to redirect, if they're coming over and they really want to interact with the child's talker. Oh, that's so and so's talker, but here, you can have this one. This is the one that you're using. And I know it's not the same because it's not going to give that auditory feedback and it's not the iPad, but it gives the teachers a strategy that is not just no, stay away. And then it becomes this like pot of gold that they're like, well, now I need it. So I feel like those have been two things that have been really helpful for teachers too, like getting poster size AAC and putting that on the board before I'm even giving them guidance to interact with the child's communication device, letting them know that like modeling up on the wall, like where would be the best place for me to put this for you? Where do you do circle time? Maybe during circle time, you can just like kind of model pick two words that you want to do just so you can get comfortable kind of pointing to it and touching it and just trying to make it become a little bit more seamless in the classroom. And I feel like some of those strategies have been helpful, and also sitting with the fact that it is okay if the AAC device is not out 100% of the time as the learner is still adjusting to it and as the teachers are still adjusting to it. And I feel like that was something that was like, I had to sit in that discomfort and be like, okay, all right, so that means I have to do other work to get AAC in here in other ways while we build to get this device in here full time. So sorry, I know that was like a lot of different strategies, but those are some of the things that I'll do. Not always all of them, and it depends on the other kids in the classroom, but those are some things that I feel like have made it a little bit more successful.
Gosh, you're bringing up so many memories of like my AAC militarism in the beginning. It makes me cringe. It really does.
I know. I
It
know.
really makes me cringe. And it's like I've just come to the point now where it's like it is not worth making an enemy over an AAC device with the person who is with this kid all day, all week. Like, if I'm making certain behavior choices because they align with my values, but then they're damaging the relationship, that's going against other values. Like there's a lot of navigating here, and it's a lot of creativity. But like, I can't force, nor do I want to force another human adult to like, just like I wouldn't want to force a child to do anything. It's like, where can we find that common ground where that teacher's like, oh my, this is really helpful. This makes easier. I want this child's communication to be more seamless, so I want to put this out. I'm thinking about one of the ways, and I'm also this happens with families too. I have a family right now where they had like a pretty traumatizing experience last year with the AAC device. They got one, and then it just disaster. We started working together a couple months ago, so they were catching up. And mom started crying at our last session. I was like, it makes sense that you don't want to try it again. It makes sense why you're crying right now. And I could tell she felt really guilty that they weren't rah, 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 let's do AAC again. She's like, we've had to recover from what happened last time. And so I think it like a push of like, right now, all the way, let's go. Maybe that's not, doesn't feel safe to some families right now. Like, that's going to sever trust with other teachers right now. It's so much complicated than just like an on-off switch. I think an approach that's helped with the phrase that's often used is buy-in. I don't know that I have mixed feelings about that term because it feels very salesy of like buy my product. But one way that I've like promoted that buy-in is by asking like what part of the day would be so much easier if this child could say something to you with a talker. If they could, what is one routine that if they could push a button and communicate something to you would be a relief and a joy. And that way it's not, look at this 2,000 words across dozens of folders with a color coding system that a lot of speech therapists couldn't even describe. That's so big. We can kind of zoom in. I say like, let's zoom in to then zoom out. Like zoom in, what is one thing? Let's find a page or a button or create a gestalt, but potential gestalt button that could meet that need. And helping them zoom into that. The other one I've done that kind of gets people excited is one of the first things I do is I program their buttons for the teachers with their face. There, yeah, you too. I have them. Okay, so what I so many memories for the teachers I had really good rapport with. I would intentionally take ugly pictures of them so they had to learn how to change it. They loved it. They're like, Miss Corinne, what'd you do? And I go, just leverage. But for the
Yeah, change
teachers,
it.
that was very select relationships.
Yeah, that's so
They loved
funny.
it. But for other teachers, it's like, let's take a really beautiful picture of you. Let's like grab it. Let's get the good lighting. It's like, you're on here. You're important in this kid's life. Like, you get a button for you. And I found that's exciting for them. Like, I could cry right now. Like, when a kid, oh my gosh, come on. When a kid hits their teacher's name button for the first time across the room, like, Come on.
I know, it's amazing. That's not necessarily, I mean, with the teachers, it'll help too. But another thing that I'll do, we have, I created a resource with a mom that I work with, and we made it for the start of the school year in September, where the child was going to have a whole new class. And the front of it says, like, your child has an AAC user in their class. And it has a couple resources on it of ways that they can talk to their child about disability and AAC and what it is and how this is an accommodation. And then there's a page that the child, the AAC user, can personalize at the back that says, like, what is one thing I want you to know about me? This is what I call my communication device. And then it's a consent form to put all of the other kids' pictures on that child's device. And that is huge, because then it gets the other kids to understand, like, oh, I'm on so and so's device. Like, that's amazing. They can talk about me now. I can show them where my picture is. They can show me. Like, and it makes it so much more meaningful for the child. It makes the class feel included and excited that it's, I just feel like that's something is like getting pictures on there of the people in the child's life is so important. And I think, like you were saying, it helps everyone. It helps teachers and kids feel important to that child's life too, which is going to help with the connection there.
And I mean, I would be programming like the center director, the person who is like working in like the lunchroom, lunch prep room, people at the front desk, because then that's also promoting like a culture around AAC beyond the classroom, where like when that child walks through the door, and the person at the front desk is like, can say hi to them, and then can that child say hi back? Then it's not, it's just, it that's that ripple effect. It normalizes AAC and it gets more people on board feeling valued. And for people who might not know how to connect with an autistic kid or connect with a GLP, this gives them one way to do so. What are some other challenges that you think come up with AAC implementation in the classroom that are important to talk about?
I feel like one of the things that comes up a lot with me is what the expectations of learning on a device are and what that can look like. I think a lot of time, and sometimes this happens, but most of the time, it's not all of a sudden this amazing communication device where they can tell us all about things, which I think when it's such a challenge to get it in the classroom and what all of the things that we've talked about, we're programming everyone's face, we're getting core boards, we're redirecting, we're talking to kids about disability. All of those things are amazing. We're doing that. And to a teacher, a child is hitting like
Goldfish,
is.
goldfish, goldfish,
And
goldfish.
we're like, I'm like, oh my God, look, they like the sound of this. And they're like,
Dancing to
what
it.
is going on? You are wild. So I think really talking to teachers too, the same way that we give those comments of like pointing out maybe those little positive things that are happening. Standing with the teacher and watching a child interact with their device and pointing out those little things too. And just sitting with them in either the discomfort of how they feel with a child engaging like that or the excitement and acknowledging that it is okay to feel that way. I feel like that is a big barrier that I run into. It's just like the teacher's feelings of how they would expect a child to be using an AAC device versus what it actually looks like in the real world. And there's when I was first starting to do AAC and a child would be hitting a button over and over again, I would be like, it was me that needed to reflect on what is this bringing up in me. And I think for me, it was bringing up like, oh, am I being a bad therapist? Am I not modeling the right way? Not thinking about, oh, this is bringing that child a lot of joy. What if I model my iPad and I interact in a similar way? What would that do to our connection? Which is just a huge shift in how I've grown as a therapist. But I think a lot of it is like reflecting on how a teacher might feel when a child's interacting with a device like that, and helping them acknowledge that it's okay, but that's something that's really hard.
I think there's two points that came up for me. The first was you can do like a front-loading conversation of, hey, when this is in play, here's what's probably going to happen. Just so you feel ready, they're probably going to babble on it. They're probably going to sim on it so that they feel ready for it. So it's not like shocking or surprising. You've prepared them that this is probably going to happen and here's why. And I feel that that can be more effective than trying to explain it while the kid is doing it, because then they're probably got high cortisol already. So you can front load it in that conversation. The other one is it's just kind of like an anecdotal expansion on what you just said. Because you have got, thank you, because I have a terrible memory. So you bringing back all of these is truly a gift. You're doing memory therapy. Thank you. But I was thinking back to the way that your response as a therapist in that classroom can really change how teachers feel about it, but also the other kids. So I had this little girl I was working with. She was one of the first autistic girls I ever worked with. And I was like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. And I look back and she was obviously a GLP. Like, text, if you open the textbook, her face would be in there. But we got her an ANC device and she was doing goldfish, 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 goldfish. I remember some of the other kids in the preschool classroom were being like, let's give her a fake name. Her fake name is Sophia. Why is Sophia saying that? Why is Sophia saying that? And I was like, okay, instead of explaining it to these other kids, let me like riff, let me do something off of it. And I noticed the rhythm underneath the goldfish, goldfish, gold. It was a very steady rhythm. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna react to this as if it's a song. And what I did was I was like, okay, what if I like put little words in between just the goldfish, goldfish? Of course, I was like dancing to it too. I was doing eat, eat, eat. So eat goldfish, eat goldfish, eat goldfish, eat goldfish. And then all the other kids were like, oh, this is really cool and interesting. Because Sophia was clearly eating goldfish. And they were able to see, okay, yes, this, she's talking about the things that she's doing. But then there's this weird lady who comes in once a week and she's doing this cool thing. And then it ended up there's a whole classroom of kids singing along with her, like babbling in tongues.
It.
It was really, really cool. But just that little decision to be like, okay, I'm gonna start singing and adding rhythm into like kind of singing a song with her, led to a classroom full of other kids being like, okay, that's kind of cool. Yeah, Sophia's talking to us.
It's funny. I don't think you've ever told me that story before, but for those of you who don't know, I did Corinne's music therapy course, like the musical SLP course. That was 10 weeks. And I don't know if we talked about it, but like I do that and I think I got it from you. When a child is hitting a button, like I'm immediately like, yes, let's go. I love this song. And doing something, adding in a word or whatever it is, and you're right, it gets the other kids to be like, oh, that is really cool. I love that.
It's not just like a string of sound anymore. It's like, oh, we can riff on it and make it interesting. It's probably something we did talk about. I don't think I shared that exact story
I
when
don't think you did either, because the
or
story doesn't sound familiar, but like I do that and I
yeah.
got that from you. So at some point, you definitely told me
Well,
about
sometimes,
it.
you know, the moments where there's some softwares out there where like it's either they don't have a button to like stop the speech or it's hard to find in the moment. I'm like, all right, we're stuck here for a while. Like, you know, when they create the whole string and it's like, well, sit down, buckle up. We're going to be here
Yes.
16,000 apples in a row. So it's like, I
You're
might
gonna.
well. I mean, I've been known to beatbox underneath it, like tapping on the floor. But I think adding in kind of like the rhythmic language that definitely gets the attention of other kids and break the tension too, because like, I know I have adverse reactions to it. Like if I'm at capacity for the day and I hear that, I really have to check my own reactivity to the sound. And humor can really cut through that.
I think humor is one that I bring in so often in my sessions just to help connect with the other kids. And I think that's another thing that's so important about the push-in model is you are helping support this child in modeling connection with other kids and also the reverse relationship. And I feel like I work a lot with the other kids to be like, oh, did you see that so and so just selected that on the talker? Like, I'm gonna go get it. And then they're like, no, I will. And
Oh.
immediately, like, there's a connection in that. And it's just like modeling these different ways that we can build authentic friendships in the classroom between these kids, letting kids know that we can talk about disability and different ways that brains work. And that's something that I feel like can be kind of uncomfortable for teachers as well, is it's not this like hush hush thing. Like, let's talk about it. Let's, work together with this.
You reminded me of something else with that. It just happened today, actually. I was doing a push-in in a preschool with a GLP who uses an AAC device. But his special interest is Chicka Chicka Boom Boom. That kid lives in a coconut. Like, he would live in a coconut tree, get him a hammock, sleep in it. Like, he loves that book. All day, it's what he talks about. He arranges letters around the room. It's beautiful. Like, you and I can sit back and be like, that's amazing.
Like, yeah.
And the teacher's really cool. She's very cool. And I can tell there's this balance of like this. I can see this kid is like so smart. He's so invested in his special interests. And also, like, I want him doing more. I want him expanding his interests. And she mentioned today how there's a little girl in the class who you can tell wants to connect with my client. She'll walk up to him, look at him, and just kind of freeze and not know what to do. And the teacher reflected, like, she doesn't really know what to do either, because she's seeing these two kids who want to connect with each other, one holistic, one autistic, and then it's just like, now what? And so I think with AAC can be a great way, and also special interests in those early childhood experiences of we can show ways to bridge that gap. I think about it kind of being like a cultural broker in a way of like, okay, I know a little bit about your culture, I know a little bit about yours. How can we meet in the middle here? And something that we did was, because this child is hyperlexic and loves Chicka Chicka Boom Boom, I saw that this child who's interested in him was playing with blocks. And I was like, okay, let's make letters out of blocks. I'm going to take your activity, your interest, and can we push it together? Went over to the kid and I just addressed her directly. And I was like, there's no way we could make the letter A out of those. There's no way. She was like, yeah, there is. And we built the letter A, and my client looks over and he was like shaking. Cause like that's the beginning of the most important gestalt of all, which is the alphabet song. And his
Yes.
way of like, can we just kind of like bring what you love, what you're good at, what you love, what you're good at, and like this meet in the middle. I was explaining it to the teacher, and she's like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I can probably do that. But yeah, I think involving the other kids and like normalizing involving the other kids, if it's allowed to, I like to definitely talk to the teacher first and be like, what's your comfort level with me directly talking to these other kids, involving them? Do you think that parents would be okay with this? I think more and more parents are excited about the idea of fostering inclusivity early in life, building allyship. But you don't necessarily want to get into a situation where a parent's like, why are you using my kid in a therapy session? So it could be worth talking with the teachers about.
Definitely. And it goes back to like that consent form that we did, where making sure that we're checking in with the parents of other kids before we're taking their photo and putting it on a child's device, things like that. But I love that idea of teaching connection in both ways, because kids want to connect, and this is such a good time to model that for them and give them those ideas to just kind of get it started and then let them run with it.
And showing the autistic kids like you have agency here. You could join in. Like, we don't, I think there's such an expectation on GLPs and autistic kids like to like catch up so then they can join in. And it's like we can equip the kids who maybe already have really robust language, who have a lot of strong social signaling, to be like, hey, get on in there, let me show you how. So I think the idea of like kind of sending them on that like little mission of going to get the AAC device can be really exciting. And also just drawing attention to your client's strengths too. Because I know my client who I just referenced, he kind of does a circuit around the room, he roves around. The other kids like notice him, but I think that the other kids have kind of learned to just tune him out too, because they're like, I don't know, he's doing his thing. So little comments like, whoa, Did you just see what? I'm so bad at coming up with names on the spot. Did you just see what Danny did? That was so cool. And they're like, I guess so. Yeah. But it's just
Yeah.
like turning a spotlight to be like, hey, this kid that you maybe kind of learned to tune out or ignore, doing interesting stuff that maybe you could add to, but not forcing them in any way.
Right. And I think it's just opening up the conversation and letting them know, because I think that was such a nice way to put it, is that like these kids are kind of taught sometimes to just mind your own business, like, and I really, really try and go in and not necessarily teach the opposite, but model the opposite. And if they see it and they're interested and it sparks some joy or connection in them, then that's going to be a natural friendship, you know? And that's what it is. It's like creating these authentic connections, not forced in either direction. But and I feel like that makes the teachers' lives easier too, because then they get to see the kids playing. They're not having to like constantly do two different things at once. Like it's nice to see.
And just like the silly anecdotal pattern is like the kids who really, really want to like help my clients are often the kids who like won't leave the teacher alone. So it's like we can kind of give them like something
Like
else
I'll
to
give
do.
you
And
a
the teachers are
break.
like, you know, it's like, Miss Tina, Miss Tina, Miss Tina, Miss Tina. It's like, hey, I don't know this. And the teacher's like,
Whatever.
thank you.
Yes, please.
We're just reallocating resources here.
Yes. Yeah. No, I love that though. But I think like teaching connection in both ways is such an important thing. Like with AAC, with language, connection, friendship. I feel like that's a big piece that I bring into classroom settings, and kids are interested in it.
They really are. Yeah. And I think like involving the other kids because you're modeling for the other children how you can interact with their neurodivergent peer. But and we know that like joint attention doesn't require eye gaze, that you know, like gaze, you're also modeling for your client who you are building a relationship with how to interact with the other peers too. And so that can also be a secondary alliance. That is that your client is witnessing, feeding off of, seeing patterns within. And so all of the interactions, I think that I used to go in and just be like, me, client, boom, you and me, baby. That's it. Like just so eager and so well-intentioned, but so annoying. And like still annoying, but different annoying. Now I go in and I'm trying to get a land, like, what is the landscape in here? What like what kind of what's the ecology of this room? What ecosystem am I coming into? And how can I be a part of it instead of like being an invasive species in the system? And it's also really, really, really hard. We can make it sound pretty and like lots of little quips right now. It's really difficult and it can be
It
really
is.
scary.
Yeah. And I think like I have the beauty of working in early intervention. So at least in Philly, whether you're doing birth to three or three to five, like this child has an IEP, IFSP for a full year. So I know when you're doing things with insurance or private, the stakes might seem a little bit higher because you don't know how many sessions you're going to have. Like I really can go in and have these connection sessions for a month, you know, and like build that rapport knowing I still have 2 years with this kid. Like, oh, you're waiting until the following year for kindergarten. Now we have almost three. Like, I have that on my side of time. So then we really can take things this slow to like build that impact. But I do, you know, acknowledge that that's not always the case when people are going in, but that is the one thing I love about early intervention. It's just like the nature of meeting parents where they are, meeting teachers, kids where they are, parent coaching, and like not really having that end date.
And I think about the rapport building, that connection building, relationship building in the beginning, kind of if possible. To let go, I think personally letting go of being like, let's get right to work, but also in whatever setting you're in, giving yourself a little bit more leeway. And like in your note, wording it in a way, like talking, I think one of the terms you can really pull from if you're trying to document the importance of that process is therapeutic alliance or working alliance. Those
I
are
like
things
that.
that are in the literature. You can find papers to support it. So working alliance and secondary alliance. And saying, like, if I'm cultivating the working alliance and therapy alliance, according to research, it is going to likely lead to improved outcomes. We are preparing the child's environment for the therapy to have more efficacy. It's kind of like with any, like, lots of other types of like medical interventions, you need to prepare the area before you do the treatment. You need to prepare the surgical field before you do the surgery. If we're just going in with speech therapy, but the environment is not therapeutic, are we getting a null result? Like, it's, you gotta understand the ecosystem that you're working in. And there's ways to talk about that that are evidence-based.
Yeah, I love that. I've never used those terms when I'm like writing a note, talking about it in an IEP meeting or anything like that. So I love to have that to support, what I'm doing.
Yeah, and I do want to share, there's another paper I will put in the chat for our live participants, but for those of you who are listening, I'm going to read out the author, the title, and the year for you to look into. So it's called Understanding the Secondary System of Therapeutic Alliance in Autism Interventions from the Perspectives of Parents and Caregivers. That's by John Robert C. Rilveria, and that is from January 2022, so pretty recent. And there is the link right there. But it talks about the importance of secondary system of therapeutic alliance. So example, like between me and a teacher, or between even like parent, teacher, parent, therapist. And it explores what are the predictors of a good alliance. And it also talks about what can get in the way. Which I think is important because if you're having a relationship with someone, you're like, I don't feel aligned. I don't feel aligned with that parent. We all have it with a parent where you're like, we just don't click. I love your kid. I respect you, and we don't click. And trying to figure out like what might be a barrier getting in the way? Is it the kind of feedback that we're giving each other? Is it the value? So this is a paper where it helps break down all of those. Some of the ones that are predictors are attitude towards treatment and level of stress that the parents are experiencing. If their baseline stress levels are through the roof, you have to be able to understand that and then modulate your recommendations to the truth of their stress level. Because as much as I would love to take the stress away from families and help them with their own mental health challenges and the world that, their personal challenges, that's not my job. It's out of my scope and I might make it worse. But that can be good information for how you tailor your treatment. You're not going to make any progress if you're giving recommendations that are incorrect for that child's exact experiences and who can follow through on it, which stinks because you're like, I want to give you the best quality recommendations, but those are useless if they're not going to be followed through on. Yeah. Okay. So let's take a breath there. Thank you so much. This was really exciting. You drudged up so many memories for me. I miss early intervention. You guys have certainly been pushing me to get in on it. And
It
so
really is the best.
it is.
I do love it.
I do miss it. I love it so much. So I really appreciate it. I feel like we covered a lot of topics tonight. For those of you who are here live, we got plenty of links in the chat. So try and open up all those tabs before we say goodbye for tonight. But I also, if you listen to the playback, you'll hear some of those citations. I also put the link if you want to learn more about Bridget and her team and her company. You should check them out. They are called Small Talk Therapeutics. They're in the Philly area. So if you know anyone that you want to refer to them, or if you live in the area, I certainly send all my Philly referrals your way. Bridget, thank you so much. This was really fun.
Thank you. It was so nice chatting with you, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Bye, everyone. Have a great night.
Bye.
Thanks so much for joining us on today's podcast. Remember to go to speechtherapypd.com to learn more about earning ASHA CEUs. We want you to get credit for the hard work you've put in to further your education. We also appreciate your support. We'd love for you to write a quick review of the podcast and subscribe.
If you're listening on a streaming platform, feel free to rate us. 5 stars is great, 4 stars is awesome, but we also appreciate honesty around here if it's lower. That way, your ratings and your reviews will help get our podcast to more clinicians like you, as well as parents and people from other professions who might benefit from learning about Gestalt language processing. Now, if you've indicated that you are part of the ASHA registry and entered both your ASHA number and a complete address in your account profile prior to the course completion, we will submit earned CEUs to ASHA for you. Please allow 1 to 2 months from the completion date for your CEUs to be reflected on your ASHA transcript. And also, please don't hesitate to tell us which topics you would like us to cover in future episodes. To get in touch, drop us a line in the comments section or send us a message on social media. We'd love to hear who you want us to interview, what topics are on your mind, and where you'd like us to investigate when it comes to the world of GLP. I hope to see you at our next episode.
Remember to visit SpeechTherapyPD.com to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode and to see our library of over 1,400 courses for all things SLP.